Merit-based immigration today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says America should have a merit-based immigration system. We find out how merit-based visas work for immigrants in Canada.
So they get a point if they speak English. They get points if they have higher educations. They get points if they have family members in the country.
Plus, how the language of white supremacy has seeped into the immigration debate.
Anti-Semitism has a long, ugly tradition of using cosmopolitanism as a dog whistle.
And later, police in Jaipur, India, are trying to solve the incessant problem of sexual harassment there.
This lady police patrol unit has been established exclusively for women and girls to curb and to prevent sexual harassment, street harassment.
Those stories today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us today, a day that we're going to take a deep dive into immigration policy. Green cards, points-based visas, even the coded language of immigration. Right now, President Trump is backing legislation proposed by two Republican senators. It's called
the RAISE Act, R-A-I-S-E. The RAISE Act will reduce poverty, increase wages, and save taxpayers billions and billions of dollars. It will do this by changing the way the United States issues green cards to nationals from other countries.
Now, this is only a proposal that we just heard about yesterday, and the chances that it'll become law are pretty slim. But it's launched a heated conversation. Monica Campbell is our Global Nation editor, and she's been closely following the story. So, Monica, just explain, first of all, this bill to us.
Sure. Well, first, it's called the RAISE Act, and that breaks down as the Reforming American Immigration for a Strong Economy Act. And what Trump is proposing is basically he's going after the green card system, and he wants to slash the number of green cards issued by half. So right now, the U.S. currently issues about 1 million green cards. They want to bring that down to about 500,000 over 10 years. And just, you know, basics here. You get a green card if someone in the U.S., a citizen, say, sponsors you. Usually green cards are for relatives. So if you are from the Philippines or India or Mexico, you can bring in your wife or you can bring in your son. They want to slash that number by half. And they also want to bring in a merit-based system.
So explain the merit-based system and how that'll work.
So that's what's controversial here. It's like a point system. So you get points based on your English skills, your job skills, your education level, your age, and you know maybe whether you have a high-paying job offer in the United States. So it's a really controversial split. They're basically proposing, you know, who's worthy and who isn't worthy to come into the United States. And I thought there was a good tweet about this by the writer Jeff Yang. He wrote, "The poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty doesn't ask for the world's, quote, huddled masses of PhDs yearning to work at Google." Hmm.
So is this reform in the context of immigration reform that so many people have been kind of wanting?
It's not at all comprehensive. The big elephant in the room are the 11 million people already in the United States undocumented. And that was you saw a much more comprehensive bill by the so-called Gang of Eight proposed to address, you know, a lot more people in the United States without papers, the legal immigration system, the whole thing. There was bipartisan support for that bill, and that bill didn't pass. It didn't become law. So this is a much more narrow proposal. It's much more controversial, much more polarizing, and therefore the chances of it actually getting through and made into law are pretty slim.
The World's Monica Campbell helping us make sense of the immigration proposal backed by President Trump. Monica, stick around if you would, please. We've got some other takes on the story, and I want to hear your thoughts. Now, when White House officials presented this immigration plan yesterday, we heard that it had been inspired by the systems in Canada and Australia. Both those countries have merit-based point systems, but it's more complicated than that. Alex Narasta is an immigration policy analyst at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He says the system in Australia has lots of critics.
The big problem with the point system is that the government sets how much each of these points are worth. So if the government thinks that, say, occupations in restaurants are more important than occupations in computer programming, then those types of workers will be favored over workers in computer programming. The problem with this is, of course, the government doesn't know which industries necessarily are the ones that demand these workers, that require these workers, where these workers would be best. So this is essentially just government planning of the types of occupations that they think are going to grow in the future. And as a result of that, there's a lot of lobbying, there's a lot of crony capitalism, there's a lot of problems.
I mean, I was kind of surprised that Canada uses this merit-based system because it's got such a reputation for being open to immigration from many different places around the world. How does this work in Canada?
What's interesting is in all this discussion, the Canadian system, people leave out three facts that are important. One, Canada allows private sponsorship of refugees, which means that the refugee flow to Canada as a percentage of their population is far greater than it is in the United States. The second factor is that the family flows to Canada are actually tremendous. They're very large. So in that way, the Canadian system is more friendly to families than the American system is. And then the last point is that Canada allows provinces to invite immigrant workers or entrepreneurs on top of the federal cap. So as a result of this, all of these flows together add up to an immigration system that is very generous compared to the United States. So for instance, about 21% of Canada's population is foreign-born. In the United States, it's only about 13.5%.
Are there cases that you could point to in either Australia or Canada that have illustrated the failures or the successes of either system?
So it's a stereotype in both of these countries that you have immigrants with master degrees or PhDs who are driving taxi cabs or doing lots of other low-wage work because the skills that they have are not well-suited to the Canadian or Australian markets. So as a result, the point system could emphasize a PhD in a subject for which there just is no labor market demand in these countries.
There are very educated people in the United States driving cabs, former ministers of information from, you know, name the country.
There are always exceptions to every rule, but the general trend when you look at the statistics is that highly skilled immigrants in the United States do better relative to other Americans, relative to other skilled workers here, than highly skilled immigrants in Canada and Australia do relative to their populations, just because the U.S. system is better at matching the skills actually demanded by our economy with the skills that the immigrants have.
That's Alex Narasta with the Cato Institute. Monica Campbell, our Global Nation editor, you heard a lot of libertarian points in there. The free market is better than the government at choosing workers. What did you think of what Alex Narasta was saying?
I agree with a lot of what he said, but it just continually strikes me that it seems like we're talking about immigrants as workers. And I think, you know, the saying goes that we wanted workers and we got families. And I think this is like a very limited way of looking at immigrants and how the U.S. is connected to people from all over the world. It sort of disregards the upside of families coming together in the U.S., you know, the ability of a family-based, you know, sponsorship, people able to reunite. And the question is, you know, should who is allowed to come into the U.S. or not come into the U.S. come down to a job offer? And is the U.S. government the best way to go about predicting, you know, how dynamic our economy is and who should be let in, who should not be let in, and where they should be working and where the demand is for the workers?
Monica, don't go. We're going to check back in with you one more time after we talk about the English language slice of this bill. Maybe you've heard that exchange between CNN reporter Jim Acosta and White House advisor Stephen Miller yesterday about the proposed changes to immigration policy. Here's Acosta asking whether a skills-based approach granting green cards is in line with U.S. tradition.
The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. Aren't you trying to change what it means to be an immigrant coming into this country if you're telling them you have to speak English? Can't people learn how to speak English when they get here?
Well, first of all, right now, it's a requirement that to be naturalized, you have to speak English. So the notion that speaking English wouldn't be a part of our immigration systems would be actually very ahistorical.
Well, not quite. It's true that the naturalization exam requires a test in English, but for immigrants who don't speak English fluently, there can be an exemption. The U.S. doesn't have an official language, but many people think English should be it. Rosalie Porter is on the board of directors for the organization Pro English. I mean, it's a small part of the bill, but it's a really important part, and it strikes a lot of emotions. I mean, you came to the U.S. at the age of 6, didn't know any English yourself. I mean, isn't it part of the American ideology that people should be allowed to do that? And we're not talking citizenship. We're just talking about coming into the country for a green card.
Well, if they're coming into the country with a green card, that implies they are going to stay, they are going to work. And without immigrants knowing some English or being ready to acquire the language, we have problems, and they are very, very expensive. The executive order that President Clinton signed that requires all sorts of organizations, and especially hospitals and doctor's offices, to provide translation services for anyone that requires them. The fact is, there are 329 languages spoken in this country today. This is a hugely expensive requirement that has cost the economy a great deal of money in the past 20 years.
Do you believe, though, that all these translation services actually have cost us more than what we've received in economic benefits from people who've come to this country and may not speak English?
Well, you're saying immigration services cost us more.
No, I'm not saying that. But do you really
economic benefits? That may be true.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we get more economic.
I'm an expert on language and the situation of immigrant children and their families. That's my area.
Your point of view, Rosalie, does it see an America that is less connected to the rest of the world?
Good heavens, how could we be more connected when we receive over 1 million immigrants every year? We are the most diverse country on the face of the earth. Where is any other country doing more to accommodate immigrants with education, with health care?
And with all those numbers being brought down by the Trump administration, you still believe that?
Look, nobody today is recommending that we stop immigration. But only in the past 40 years, our population in the United States has doubled, and 60% of that increase is from immigration. Maybe we should look at reducing the level of immigration. Let the bill come before Congress and let it be discussed in open forum. Let's see what they decide.
Rosalie Porter there with the organization Pro English. Monica Campbell still with us. Quickly, Monica, your reaction?
It's always interesting to hear that we are an incredibly diverse country, but that perhaps we've reached this limit. We've heard this before, and again, we're hearing it now. But there are really big parts of the country that are going the other way. California overturned its ban on bilingual education, and there are no studies out there that show English-speaking immigrants are more likely to benefit the U.S. economy. So what we're seeing is the Trump administration pushing back pretty drastically on this right now.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much for walking us through all this, Monica.
You're welcome.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Marco Werman here with The World. Kenya goes to the polls next Tuesday to elect new leaders. And guess what? This will sound familiar. One of the key issues affecting people there is the state of health care. The healthcare system in Kenya is in turmoil. The country has been hit by two long strikes by doctors and nurses, and there are allegations of corruption. My BBC colleague Ann Soy looks at what impact this all may have on the upcoming elections.
Kenya's nurses making their voice heard on the streets of Nairobi. They've boycotted work for weeks, demanding for better terms. Political campaigns are on, but no one is talking about them.
Hello, I'm asking all the nurses to stay put until Jesus Christ comes back.
Yeah. I'm Boris Odhiambo Ketu, the Acting General Secretary of the Kenya National Union of Nurses.
The nurses give 90% of the healthcare services in public health facilities, and when they are out on strike, it means the services are totally grounded and the Kenyan citizens are not enjoying their rights of quality healthcare services. The president, the deputy president, the governors, the opposition leaders have failed the Kenyan citizens because they have failed even to take one day off out of their campaigns, listen to the nurses, and get a solution for the nurses. It is a very big disappointment.
I'm walking down a dirt path in Kibera, one of Nairobi's slums. On my left, I can see a woman deep-frying fish for sale. On the right, there are three girls queuing to collect water from the community watering point. In front of me is the village public toilet. The majority of people who go to public hospitals are low-income earners. They live in areas like this. I'm going to meet a 16-year-old girl I will call Janet, who, like many girls here, has dropped out of school after she became pregnant. I can see on your arm you have an IUV syringe. Why are you walking around with it?
They said that I have ulcers. It has eaten the whole of my stomach and my sugar.
Blood sugar.
Yeah, it's high. And I have to have this on my hand.
She was taken ill last week and rushed to a public hospital. But the nurse's strike forced her to seek treatment in a privately owned health facility. But she fears she might not complete her medication. The hospital has asked her not to return until she clears an outstanding bill. Her mother is worried and helpless. Her father is a casual laborer, and I make samosas for sale by the road. On a good day, I make $2, and that's what I use to feed our four children. The treatment is very expensive.
The story is repeated in many homes due to two prolonged strikes, first by doctors, then by nurses.
Health is a function shared between the national government and a new second tier of leadership spread across 47 counties. Dr. Chitai Murabula is a former union leader.
Although devolution was a good idea, but because of the challenges encountered during the implementation, the quality of service provision still remained very poor.
He reckons that the devolution of health services hasn't really worked.
That transition was difficult because the counties did not have the capacity to handle the health services in terms of human resource, in terms of the running of hospitals, which then resulted into discontent.
6122, room 12. But not all is lost. The number of women giving birth in hospitals has doubled since the government abolished delivery charges. More than half the Kenyan population now has medical insurance, and state-of-the-art diagnostic equipment is available in hospitals across the country. But without these nurses at work in hospital, those gains mean nothing. The poor will continue to suffer. Both the ruling coalition and the Council of Governors, led by an opposition politician, have failed to resolve the issues and end the strikes quickly. It's a big issue that politicians have conveniently ignored as they seek votes, a conspiracy of silence.
The BBC's Anne Soy reporting there from Kenya. Our friends at the BBC asked the Kenyan government for comment, but none was given before this report went to air. There are approximately 40,000 sexual assaults and rapes reported in India each year, but the real number is likely a lot higher than that. Women often don't come forward because they have no idea if their concerns will be addressed by the male-dominated police force. Jaipur is one city in India trying to change that. Their plan? A special police unit made up entirely of women who patrol the streets to rein in harassment and violence towards women. Kamal Shekawat heads the all-woman police unit in Jaipur. Tell us how this all-woman police force started.
There are a lot of, you know, complaints about eve-teasing and street harassment, sexual harassment against women and girls. And sometimes women and girls hesitant to come forward. So this lady police patrol unit has been established exclusively for women and girls to curb and to prevent sexual harassment, street harassment. We have identified 200 hotspots or 200, we can say, sensitive points in malls, parks, schools, colleges, etc. And this unit does the patrolling from early in the morning to 10 in the evening. So basically the purpose is to curb and control, to prevent the sexual harassment, street harassment against women.
So eve-teasing, that's the phrase used in India for sexual harassment. Do the officers get special training for this? I mean, did you have to kind of recruit a whole new unit?
Yeah, actually, though we have already a lot of lady police personnel from last many years. This is a new initiative in which this Lady Police Patrol unit has been established exclusively for to curb this sexual harassment cases. And special training has been provided because they have to ride the two-wheelers. They will be on two-wheelers. So the two-wheeler riding training, self-defense training, wireless operating, we can say refresher courses has been provided to this unit.
I was in Mumbai a couple of years ago and witnessed a kind of neighborhood watch program where men were involved to interrupt Eve teasing and sexual harassment when it was spotted. Did you try other schemes before turning to an all-female police squad like neighborhood watch or citizen policing?
Yeah, we have a lot of schemes, actually. Every district of Rajasthan, we have women police station. All the employees, all the staff is women. From the bottom to top rank, all are women. Then we have, one very important initiative is that we have established a helpline number, 1090. So it operates all over Rajasthan. In India, Rajasthan is a state, so it operates all over Rajasthan. Then we have another initiative in which we have provided a WhatsApp number to register the cases of violence against women. So many initiatives has been taken, and this is one of them.
Kamal Shekhawat, thank you very much for your time today.
Most welcome. Thank you.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. As an African-American actor in early 19th century New York, Ira Aldridge experienced a lot of racist abuse.
So he decided to go to the UK, to England, and try there. And he became one of the great Shakespearean actors of the 19th century.
Today, he was honored in Coventry, England. That story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Back now to our conversation about the White House-backed immigration plan. It's a highly charged topic. Case in point, that exchange we heard about earlier between CNN reporter Jim Acosta and White House advisor Stephen Miller at yesterday's press conference on the bill. The legislation would give higher priority to English speakers. That prompted CNN's Acosta to ask Miller if that meant the U.S. would just be letting in people from Britain and Australia. Here's how Miller responded.
It shows your cosmopolitan bias. And I just want to say,
it sounds like you're trying to engineer the racial and ethnic flow of people.
It may sound a little like it falls into the category of the word elitist, but cosmopolitan also has an ugly history of anti-Semitism. Nazis in Germany and Joseph Stalin both weaponized the word. Christina Lopez is a senior researcher at Media Matters. She's been following trends in language used by white supremacists and the alt-right. So what does a word like cosmopolitan actually signal to white supremacists, Christina?
Well, like you very well said, anti-Semitism has a long, ugly tradition of using cosmopolitanism as a dog whistle. And the thing about dog whistles is that they work kind of like Easter eggs. You have to know what you're looking for to find them. So therefore, they kind of like land with a very specific kind of audience, but fly over the heads of everybody else. So on a sort of speech that was meant for public consumption, like yesterday's press briefing, Stephen Miller was able to just throw in the word cosmopolitan and, you know, make it sound like he meant elitist. And when confronted by anyone, he would be able to say, you know, well, no, of course you're making this up. I am myself Jewish, or be able to get away with it. And the thing about dog whistles is that they have to work into a larger context. And the context that we have in this particular instance is that the White House in the past 24 hours has cited explicitly groups that are anti-immigrant nativist groups. Steve Miller cited the Center for Immigration Studies. The White House website had the praise from the group, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR, and the group Numbers USA. These three groups have been labeled hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. So those citations that are so explicit leave very little room for interpretation to whether we should call it a dog whistle or not.
Do you think Stephen Miller was connecting the propaganda dots when he used the word, or was he kind of referring to a vague sense of globalism, cosmopolitanism?
So it's very hard to know what was going through the minds, and that's why dog whistles are so insidious, because they can be used innocuously, and they kind of give an out to whoever is using them to be able to say, that's not what I meant. The thing is, they are not meant for the general population. You're throwing red meat for the well-attuned ear that has the context, the larger context, where you want it to land. So dog whistles, in that sense, allow you to appeal to a certain part of the population that it wouldn't be okay to appeal in a general speech like the White House press briefing. But these groups are attuned and they are listening. And Stephen Miller is right now being celebrated in the corners of the alt-right, white nationalistic internet as a hero for keeping the purity of the population in America by kind of trying to curtail immigration.
There are other words in the whole white supremacist alt-right movement. And I mean, cosmopolitan, you know, you can find that in a dictionary. What are some of the other words that you wouldn't find in a dictionary that the alt-right would understand immediately?
The thing about the alt-right on the internet, specifically online, and this is where this movement had sort of grew and was able to form actual communities. They, like any other community, online or offline, have developed a sort of, we can call it a dialect that kind of lets them know that they're part of the same community, and therefore their own set of inside jokes and their own set of slang. So to them, like the one they use the most, and it's pretty much to put down others, it's the cuck.
Right.
Cuck means a coward, someone that's lame. And they borrow that word actually from the slang of pornography, but that, now they have adapted it, and they tend to use it specifically to people that they see as feckless or spineless. And that's their big word of showing sort of a alpha maleness on top of everybody else.
And then there's just the word elite, which, you know, you can find in the dictionary, and it just has a very potent meaning when it's taken out of that context.
Exactly. You can assign the meaning that you want depending on the context. And in the context of white nationalism, the alt-right, even the pro-Trump new right, to them, elitism just speaks to media or bi-coastal elites. And basically they've added a negative connotation to something that, you know, it's pretty much moral neutral in the normal sense of the word.
Christina Lopez with Media Matters. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The immigration bill that we've been talking about a lot today, there's one group that wouldn't be affected by it, so-called guest workers, people who come into the country for seasonal work. By some estimates, more than 1 million people get visas for these programs each year. For more on this, we checked in with Jennifer Hunt. She served in the Labor Department under President Obama. So I asked her for a quick overview of these seasonal work programs.
Well, for seasonal workers, there are two main programs, the agricultural and the non-agricultural seasonal worker program. So the agricultural program is called the H2A, and the non-agricultural is the H2B.
Yeah. Give me a couple of examples of seasonal work that would qualify for either of these visas.
Just generally things to do with tourism, actually, in both cases, the winter and summer. So working at the beach in various capacities, working in ski resorts in various capacities. So it could be ski instructor or working in the bar or whatever.
And then you've got H-1B visas and O visas. Just briefly talk about those as well.
Yeah, so those are different in that although they are temporary visas, they're a lot less temporary than the other ones. So the H-1B, for example, which among the temporary visas is one of the larger ones, you initially get it. You get the visa for 3 years and it can be renewed once. And I'm actually glad that you mentioned the O-1 because some people think that the most skilled workers are admitted into the H-1B, but actually that's the O-1 visa where you have to submit documents and so forth, establishing that you've already accomplished abroad quite a bit in your field. H-1Bs, I don't want to call them that unskilled, they're certainly not unskilled, but some of them are perhaps more like fairly skilled rather than extremely skilled workers. So, for example, computer programmers.
Trump has said that foreign workers are taking jobs away from U.S. citizens and hurting Americans. But then last month, his administration announced it would raise the visa cap for low-wage seasonal workers by 15,000. Isn't there a contradiction there?
There is a contradiction, so I'm not going to try and explain the contradiction. However, the thing that's incorrect is to think that immigration actually does hurt the U.S. economy. So I was a member of this National Academies panel that brought out a report in September on the economic impact of immigration, and it comprised the top economists and demographers who work on immigration and spanned a range of views. And in our consensus report, we do say that immigration helps not only increase the overall size of the economy, but also the part of the pie that's going to the native born. And so the controversy about immigration should be only about how that increased pie is being distributed amongst natives. So is it all going to firms? Is anyone actually losing? So in general, there are actually winners and losers from immigration, even as it increases the size of the pie available for natives. So although our report actually had a consensus that average wages are not affected by immigration in the U.S., we did agree that high school dropout natives were hurt by immigration.
So Trump is also being criticized for bringing in seasonal workers to his resorts. I know Stephen Miller responded to that, saying the bill isn't about seasonal workers, but people are still seeing, still conflating this and seeing hypocrisy. Is that fair?
Well, if President Trump thinks that his job is to protect American workers, and yet his own businesses, he does something which he believes hurts American workers, there's obviously a contradiction there. It seems hypocritical to me to be opposed to bringing in immigrants in general and unskilled immigrants in particular, and then to be hiring them in your own company. That does seem hypocritical to me.
Jennifer Hunt, professor of economics at Rutgers, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Sometimes if you're an immigrant, it can take years to get your papers in order so you can live and work here legally. In the case of one immigrant from Northern Ireland, Malachy McAllister, make that three decades. Members of Congress have even written legislation on his behalf. But as Ashley Cleek reports from New York, McAllister's long effort to stay in the U.S. might be over.
When I first call Malachy McAllister, he says he's happy to talk. But he warns, it's a long story, 30 years long. We sit in his Ford pickup outside a bar he owns in Midtown Manhattan. McAllister pulls out his iPad, Googles his own name, and up come a bunch of photos.
Hillary Clinton's here, Peter King's here, and there's our president.
There's a picture of Donald Trump and his sister, Marianne Trump Barry, a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. In 2006, Barry wrote that McAllister and his family, from Ireland, should be allowed to stay here. She implored authorities to, quote, not remove decent men and women merely because they may have erred at one point in their lives. McAllister's case was denied, but since 2007, politicians have submitted private bills to Congress to help him, saying he served time in Ireland, has built himself up in the U.S., and has a clean record here. That's now changing under Trump. His administration says immigrants can no longer rely on private bills to avoid deportation, arguing it's a tactic that protects criminals. McAllister now worries he'll have to return to a country he fled 30 years ago.
They're not focused on the good things that you do in life. They're focused on what you have done, the bad things that you've done.
McAllister's saga starts in Belfast, where he grew up in the 70s and 80s. It was a time known as the Troubles, a long conflict in Northern Ireland that pitted a Catholic minority against a Protestant majority. McAllister was Catholic, and remembers being searched and threatened by the police. His wife was shoved out of a moving police car when she was pregnant.
I think it's critical for people to understand that when you're living in an environment where there's day and daily shootings and murders and killings, what other alternative do you have to fight back?
In 1981, in response to the death of Irish revolutionary Bobby Sands, McAllister joined an Irish nationalist paramilitary group. He served as a lookout during an attack on a cop. He was convicted of conspiracy to murder and spent 3 years in prison. When he got out, he worked construction and tried to move on. Then, in 1988, gunmen attacked McAllister's home. McAllister wasn't there, but his four kids were.
26 rounds from an AK-47 shot into the house, directly into the house at them.
The McAllisters fled and eventually made it to the U.S. But a judge denied the family asylum based on McAllister's crimes in Ireland.
You know, once you're tagged with that quote-unquote terrorist, then that's very difficult to overcome.
The family was ordered deported, but they're still in the U.S.
Irish Echo!
Ray O'Hanlon edits the Irish Echo, a newspaper in New York.
May I help
He's
you?
Covered McAllister's case for years.
And this has been before the courts, before the Congress, before lawyers, before the court of public opinion, before anybody you can think of. And yet here we are, 21 years later, and it is still not resolved.
Not resolved in part because of those bills politicians have submitted to support the McAllisters. They never pass, but now, with the Trump administration, McAllister may only get a 9-month extension to stay here legally, unless he can get his case reopened. McAllister's not optimistic. Even though evidence has surfaced about collusion between British security forces and the men who shot up his home years back, it's up to the Department of Homeland Security to reopen his case. And with the top spot at DHS vacant, it's unclear what's next. McAllister is also exhausted.
Every day, 24/7, I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm thinking of what the possibilities are, where we're going to be, should I sell the house tomorrow, should I pack up the business. I'm just unsure of what the future holds here.
During the years in limbo, McAllister's wife was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and died.
It's been difficult. And I haven't stopped. I've worked hard in this country, even to simply maintain, for want of a better word, sanity.
McAllister's next check-in with immigration agents is in October. He says he doesn't know what to expect. For The World, Ashley Cleek, New York.
When The World isn't on your radio, don't forget you can find us online 24/7 at PRI.org. We've got our stories there, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We've also got videos and slideshows and all sorts of things we can't offer you on the radio show. It's also where you can subscribe to our daily and weekly podcasts. Again, that's PRI.org. If you think you know Jane Austen's England, think again. It was more diverse than you might imagine. London's first Indian restaurant opened in 1810, and in the 1820s, a young American man burst onto the scene and quickly became one of the country's leading Shakespearean actors. His name was Ira Aldridge, and he was black. This week, Aldridge was honored in the city of Coventry with a plaque on the site of the theater where he first came to prominence. Tony Howard is an English professor at Warwick University in England and heads the Multicultural Shakespeare Project.
Ira Aldridge was born in New York in 1807, and his father was a lay preacher and wanted his son, Ira, to go into the clergy. And he may have had some clerical training, but he was drawn to the theater, and particularly to the black theater that emerged in New York in the 1820s.
Right. I mean, he actually started
acting.
There
was a lot of opposition to black performers, and he was beaten up in the street. So he decided to go to the UK, to England, and try there. And he became one of the great Shakespearean actors of the 19th century.
Did he think he would find a less hostile, less racist world there?
I think he did feel that. However, he was slightly optimistic in that. Pretty well what happened was that his audiences were divided. There were those who said, this is a very interesting and extraordinary young actor. And the fact that he is a black actor makes him more interesting and fascinating. But for many people, it was an insult because this is still a society where there is a great deal of slavery in the British Empire. And in order to combat the idea of increasing abolition, performers like Ira had to be stopped. And so there was a great deal of violent aggression, not physical violence this time, but violence in the press.
Yeah, what did they say in the press? What have you read?
It's obscene.
Like what?
Normally it's to do with the fact that essentially this is not a human being. This is someone from Africa, therefore from a slave culture. And one review said, we have seen performing horses, we've seen performing dogs, now this. So astonishing stuff. But on the other hand, there were many people who just recognized the great talent.
How much of that racism was linked to the fact that he was kind of interpreting Shakespeare, this British icon, this English icon.
Yeah, totally. It was okay if he was playing one of the black roles in popular melodramas, but doing Shakespeare is a kind of violation. He has no right to do that, not even to play Othello.
Right. And
those are English words, and therefore they're white people's words.
And before Aldrich played Othello, Othello was often portrayed as kind of a mildly Arab figure. He was a Moor. But today we think of Othello as black. Mm-hmm. Talk about that evolution, how much Aldrich is responsible for that.
To begin with, he imitated Edmund Kean, who was famous for playing what was called a tawny Arabic Othello. But increasingly, what Ira was praised for was his realism. And so I think increasingly he drew on his own experience and his own feeling.
He also had this really interesting private life. He claimed to be a descendant of the princely Fula people in Africa. He traveled around in fancy carriages, and his wife and mistresses were white. I mean, I can't imagine him getting away with this in the U.S. How did he manage that in Europe?
He managed it by being a master of publicity. Like, he claimed to be directly from Africa because he knew that that would get him publicity. He claimed to be called originally Mr. Kean because that meant that people who admired Edmund Kean would want to see the black Kean. Basically, I think he set his eye on wanting to be respected in society, and he knew that talent would get him there. And so he traded on the fact, the supposed fact, that his first wife, who was English, who married him early on in England, was the illegitimate daughter of a member of parliament. Now, that wasn't true, but it created another kind of fantasy around him that he knew people would be fascinated by. He altered the way people thought.
So a very important figure. And today, Coventry's paying homage to Ira Aldrich. Speeches, they will be remembering him. And a plaque will be kind of placed in his honor. You had a lot to do with getting this plaque in place in Coventry today. Can you talk about how difficult that was? Or did you get any pushback?
It wasn't difficult in that once I told people about this story, which was fairly new to me, I must say, and completely new to most people, once I told this story and asked people to look at the history of their own town, everybody wanted to help. Times change. A city goes through dark periods and happy periods, but you have to have a sense of history and culture to carry you through.
Tony Howard, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for calling.
Tony Howard there at Warwick University in England. We close the show today with a story behind a song. It's a legend, really, of how the marimba got introduced to Colombia. Here's Adrian Sabogal of the band Redil Cuarteto to tell us about it.
My main project is called Redil Cuarteto, and we make some marimba traditional music of Colombia combined with jazz and contemporary elements. We have the essence of this tradition that is a very Afro-Colombian tradition. And so I want to introduce one of the songs of our third album. This song is called El Duende Cojo. It's about a dwarf. People in the regions tell a very old story about a dwarf that came to teach them the marimba sounds. So this song is El Duende Cojo, the dwarf.
That was Adrian Sabogal from Colombia. He's with the band Redil Cuarteto, and he was telling us the story behind the song El Duende Cojo. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.
PRI, Public Radio International.